welcome to another episode of Audio Dust Jacket. I'm your host, Kevin Finn, and we have a great show for you today. First up on Audio Dust Jacket, we have Joseph Calloway with his book, The Two-Word Miracle, Clients First, and it was written by him and his wife, Joseph and Joanne Calloway. Welcome, Joseph.
Good morning. How are you?
I am doing wonderful. Before we go into this book, I'm really interested about it because I grew up in the real estate world. Tell us just a little bit about your background.
Well, we've been in real estate for 15 years. Prior to that, we were following our passion, and we were book collectors, but that didn't make enough money, so we decided we'd get into something that did. And we've been doing real estate for the 15 years. We had a fortunate experience because at first we were terrible. We were awful agents. We were very motivated, but it was all about us and the money and everything. And we had an early experience. We had a transaction where we had both the buyer and the seller, and it was not a good deal for either one. And we were on like counter offer number 6 or 7. We were going back and forth, and Joanne said we should probably undo this deal. And I kind of kept the car on the road, and I said, "What do you mean?" And she said, "It's not a good deal for either party, and we should undo the deal." When they ask us, and they always do, they always turn to the agent at some point, and they ask, you know, what we thought. We needed to tell them that it wasn't enough money for the buyer, and it wasn't enough money for the seller, and it was too much house for the buyer. And you know, we needed to find them other people, other transactions. So, what happened was we did that, but fortunately the client stayed with us the next day. But the next day we were changed. We found that our perspective had switched from ourselves and our needs to the client and their needs, and that was the beginnings of Clients First.
And I'm sure that led to booming success in the real estate industry because people would trust you.
Well, we have had our track record is that we did $1 billion in our first 10 years in sales. We sold over 5,000 homes, and I haven't found anyone else that's done that yet.
That is awesome. So that led you to now writing this book, right?
Yes.
All right.
Yes, we were inspired to write the book actually about. I think we'd been in the business 3 or 4 years, and we were at our first panel. You know, you get invited to do panels when you're in real estate, and we were at this panel, and afterwards there was this lady that came up. She waited her turn because there's always people who want to speak to the panelists after an event, and she waited her turn. She asked Joanne. She said, "You know, Joanne, I've been in the business for 20 years, and you've had such success. What is your secret for success?" And Joanne proceeded to tell her for about 10 minutes about how we took care of our clients and put them first and everything. And at the end, she said, you know, she waited patiently, and then at the end, she said, "I know all that. You know, what's your real secret?" and that really bothered us. It wasn't her fault. You know, she was actually just like everybody else, like we had been, you know, trying to find our way. But it was right there in front of her, and she couldn't see it. And so that nagged at us for years and years. And in 2006, we decided we'd write a book about it. Unfortunately, the market then tanked, and so we were very busy trying to, you know, keep our business afloat. And we didn't actually start the book until 2010.
Well, yeah, I know that was a rough time for all builders, realtors, and everything. I was actually in that realm, luxury home building, and now I'm on the radio. So,
well, it was a terrible time, but what kept our doors open was the our client database. Our phone kept ringing. We had lots of people to help. It was a time that tough time, and our clients kept ringing. They brought themselves and they brought their friends and family because we were somebody that they could trust to tell them the straight of things. And that was a key part of it.
So I think your book is really a necessity for anyone that wants to be a good realtor or good business person, putting the client first. But I have to think that it has to be something you have to go in 100%. You have to fully believe in it for it to work, or you're not going to come across genuine. Is that true?
That's true. It begins with a commitment. In the book, we have a path to clients first. In the back of the book, it's 11 steps, and the first step is to make the commitment. You have to make that change. You have to switch from it being all about you to being all about the client. And then step two is to speak the commitment, sort of like you go to Weight Watchers and talk to people and get weighed. You know, you have to recommit every day. And then step three is keeping the commitment. So the first three steps are all about the commitment to the client.
Sounds like a complete mental exercise program.
It's not so much an exercise as a transformation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, exercise sounds hard. You know, this was it actually made everything easy once you switch to the client's first viewpoint. Then everything becomes easy. There's three keys in the book: complete honesty, total competence, and unwavering care. And when you are totally honest with people, you just go to bed at night. You don't have to think about it. When you work at being totally competent, then you don't end up with a bunch of issues at the end of the day or at the end of the month. In any business, there's you have issues with people that are unhappy, and when we practice clients first, we don't have that. And then when you take care of people, you have a satisfaction that you don't get when you're just taking care of yourself. So it makes everything easy in the end because you don't have to work at it.
It sounds like you talked about honesty, and I feel like realtors a lot of the time get a bad rap. They have a negative connotation with them as salespeople. But I bet that knocks people off their feet when you're like, yeah, you shouldn't buy this or this, with just being completely honest about something.
You know, we have clients that they see it in our eye, they hear it in our voice, they know that they can rely on what we say. It truly is because it comes from us, but they get it. It's a little mystic, I guess. You know, they people get it. You know, they feel it.
Well, it's got to make you guys feel good, too. You're putting people in their homes. You're giving them a dream. You're helping them build their family. It's like you're part of the family.
Oh, yes, yes. You know, I had somebody a few years back ask me, you know, what was my biggest real estate transaction? And it took me several minutes to think about it, you know, what was that, you know. But they asked me what was my most memorable, and it was a gentleman that was retiring. It was a clockmaker. And, you know, he had a house full of clocks, big grandfather clocks, and we had to help him get those sold. And then we had to try and get the most money for the house because that was all he had in the world. And then we found him a small condo, and we ended up actually moving him and stocking the refrigerator. His name was Mr. Williams. And it was, you know, that was the most memorable because it was the most rewarding to us.
That's a great story. I have to know, was it difficult? Like, what was the hardest part about writing this? Was it easier writing it with someone else, or did you guys have conflicts on what you should or should not put in the book?
Well, I get to tell you this because Joanne's not on the line. what we did was, when we finally made the commitment, she left me at the house each morning and went to the office, and I was expected to write, you know, several pages. And then we would meet for lunch, and then the afternoon was I was back in the office. So each morning I was all alone, and I missed her so much. Each chapter, each page, it was kind of a love letter to her, because at lunch I would hope that she would laugh or cry, and you know, because those are the good things. So that was the process. You wouldn't want to have read what I wrote first, though. Joanne was very much the editor and the policeman. You know, she made it the book it is.
Sounds like you guys make a great team.
We do.
So how can our listeners reach out? Because I think everyone should, well, first, can other people that aren't in the real estate world and other business fields use this book to their advantage? Or?
You know, this is the wonderful thing about the book. The book came out in October, and we've gotten so many letters and cards. And at first it was, you know, because our emphasis was we were agents, so we tried to market to agents and everything. But our publisher, John Wiley, they felt that it wasn't a real estate book. It was a business book. And so it's in the business category. And the correspondence that we're getting now, we got a Volvo dealer sent us this very touching long letter about how his business was changed by changing his philosophy to clients first. And then he found this book, and it was, you know, he just couldn't help but write us a long letter about it. We've had young people in a number of different walks of life. We have American Salon just picked it up for an article because it applies to stylists and hairdressers, because, I mean, what's more personal in working with a client than that, you know? And so it really cuts across all boundaries.
Good, because, yeah, I do think clients first can apply to every aspect of business, and I think it'll make money for anybody if you're that genuine. So how can our listeners reach out and get this book? I know it's on Amazon, but how can they reach out, get the book? Do you guys have a blog that they can subscribe to for just weekly advice? Or
you can. We have a website for the book. It's clientsfirstbook.com, and there's a lot of content there, and you get to read all the letters. We call it the cry pages, but it's wonderful. And you can order the book. Actually, you can get the book anywhere books are sold. Barnes and Noble. You can Amazon.com, of course, BarnesandNoble.com. You can order it, but it's available everywhere.
All right. Well, Joseph, thank you so much for being on and telling us about this amazing book. And if you guys
write one
in the future, we'd love to have you back on.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, you have a great day.
You too.
Bye. Next up on Audio Dust Jacket, we have Alex Greenwood with his book, Kickstarter Success Secrets. Welcome to the show, Alex. So, Alex, tell us just a little bit about yourself before we get into this book, which I'm really interested about.
Well, thanks. I'm a public relations and marketing consultant in Kansas City, Missouri, and I'm also a writer of mystery thriller novels. I have a small but successful series of mystery thriller novels, and one of the things I've found when trying to get those books out there is trying to come up with the money to get a paperback version of the books out, because I do independent publishing, and that led me directly to kickstarting.
Okay, well, let's go straight into the book then. First, explain to everyone what crowdfunding is and maybe a little bit about Kickstarter, which I think is one of the most popular crowdfunding sites.
Right. Crowdfunding is, if you've heard the term crowdsourcing, you know that's basically where, through social media in particular, you ask a question to a bunch of people and get their answers, and presumably out of those answers you'll find the solution you need to your problem.
Oh, yeah.
Crowdsourcing, Kevin, would be a similar deal where you make a case to people, generally through social media or email or your blog, and you say, look, I have this idea for a creative project. I would really like some investor support on this, and if I could count on you to invest in this, be a backer, on the back end of this, once we succeed, I'll get you certain perks or rewards for your, you know, for your trust in me. And that's really what Kickstarter is in a nutshell. It's basically a platform where somebody with a creative project can make their case to people, friends, family, strangers, whomever they can get to go look at the proposal on the website, and they can hopefully succeed in getting that kind of funding to do what they need to do.
Yeah, and I love the concept. I think it really cuts out the middleman. It goes straight from the person making the product to the consumer, and the consumer can tell them what they want instead of having all this market research and they saying, well, you know, we don't think people want to buy that. So the consumer actually can go out there and say, hey, no, I want this. I'm going to give you money towards it and make it happen.
Right. You know, my problem, I've been publishing my mystery series as e-books for years and doing very well, but people kept saying, you know, Alex, we'd love it if the John Pilot series was paperbacks. And I managed to fund the first couple of the trilogy I've done so far myself, but when it came time for the third one, I realized that just the cost for setting up a paperback book, paying a cover artist, paying people to typeset it, those things that I couldn't do well, it just ate up all my profits from the ebook. And while it's a nice thing to have, and it's great that my books are in a couple of libraries and several bookstores, the real profit center for me is in ebooks. So I did a Kickstarter. I launched in July 2012 a 21-day Kickstarter campaign to try to get the money together to get the paperback version of my third novel, Pilot's Ghost, done. And I'll tell you, I made a lot of mistakes, and I made, I think, a lot of good strategic decisions. And that's what I cover in Kickstarter Success Secrets, which is itself an ebook available on Amazon and just about anywhere you can find ebooks.
Well, let's go in and talk about some of these secrets, because I don't think if people realize that if they want to write a book, it's basically like pre-selling your book once you meet your goal.
Right. And the thing that was different about me is that, you know, I wasn't saying, if you give me the money, I'll write the book. What I told people was, I'm going to write this book no matter what. But here's the thing. If you want a paperback version, if you care enough about this series and you want a paperback rather than just an ebook version, then I'm going to need some help. And that's how it happened for me. I've seen some Kickstarters, Kevin, where they say, give me the money and then I'll write the book. And, you know, I would be less likely to back somebody like that. I want to see some proof of product beforehand, and it's kind of, you know, a lot of people, especially if they've never written a book before, it's kind of a iffy deal if they don't know what they're getting into. But that's one reason I think mine was successful, was that they knew, the people who backed me knew they were going to get a product in the end.
And you had credibility. You had these books previous to that and sort of a fan base.
I do. It was a small fan base, but I was lucky in that the second book had been nominated for a Kindle Book Review Award for Best Mystery. Actually, it was a semifinalist for Best Mystery, and it was named a page turner by a really nice literary magazine. So, I mean, I had some credibility, you're right, of being, okay, you know, J. Alexander Greenwood's books are for real. He's not going to take the money and go to Costa Rica. He's going to, you know, put together a nice paperback for us. And that's what I did, and I, you know, but like I said, I made mistakes on the way. Being a new first-time Kickstarter, you know, I did a 3-week tight campaign, and it's generally recommended you do a full month campaign.
Oh, yeah.
And the reason I think I made a mistake in that, even though I got 106% of my goal raised, is towards the end when all that money, the money really started coming in. I realized if I just kept this going maybe a full 4 weeks instead of 3 weeks, I probably could have gone significantly higher over my goal. But, you know, I don't want to get greedy or anything, but there's just certain lessons like that that I put in Kickstarter Secrets or Success Secrets that tell people, okay, if you're going to do this, consider, you know, the length of time you're going to do your project. Consider credibility factors like you mentioned. The whole thing. I can run the whole gamut for you, but it's all in the book.
Okay, definitely. Do you talk about the pitfalls of crowdfunding and the negative aspect of that's going on?
There are some negatives, and I do talk about that in the book, as a matter of fact, that there are some people that really make it rough for the rest of us who want to do crowdfunding.
Definitely.
Because, Kevin, you've probably heard stories of people who are like, fund my trip to the wine country, you know, I'll write a book about it, you know, or buy me this furniture. I want to do a book on art or furniture as art, you know, those things. And fortunately, those generally don't get through. And it's kind of buyer beware. And the
Definitely.
Trick that I tell people, it's not a trick, the tip I give people is this, to people who want to be Kickstarters, is be credible. You need to post a video of yourself talking about what you're doing. I posted a corny video that seemed to work, but people realize that's a real guy. Doesn't look like he's going to take my money and run.
Yeah,
he's got a track record. So, you know, credibility, that's the first thing. Second thing is really make sure you have a project that's worth investing in. Ask yourself, would you, if you weren't yourself, would you invest in that? You know, I understand completely. I ask people I know, I ask family and friends and some people to support me. Not everybody kicked in, and here's why. Not everybody reads mystery novels. Not everybody cares about reading. Not everybody wants to do that. So My feelings weren't hurt. All I asked them to do was pass the word on to somebody who they knew who might enjoy a mystery novel.
Definitely. I think that's the best attitude to have. And to me personally, having crowdfunded before also, when people actually donate to your projects, then it makes you feel just absolutely amazing. It makes you, you know, these people believe in you, and it sort of helps with that also.
Yeah, I hadn't realized you'd crowdfunded as well. And you know also, I don't know if you have this experience, one other thing that can happen, and I don't think it's a horrible thing. One of my backers, I think he was about a $50 backer. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. he had some health problems, and he hit me the first week as a supporter, and then by the time it came time to charge his credit card after it was successfully done, the money just wasn't there, And so, but Kickstarter did not penalize me for that. They went ahead. It didn't make the difference between making my goal or not, but it was pretty close.
But I think this is awesome. What do you think about the future of crowdfunding? I love it. I believe in it. I've used it for video projects. How is it going to survive? Because I know right now there's legal battles between people scamming, and there's no way to get your money back if people don't deliver on products. What do you think the future is going?
Well, I think it's just like anything else. It's a new frontier. You're going to have your Wild West period, where it's kind of anything goes, buyer beware, caveat emptor. There's going to be some bad apples. There's going to be some bad operators out there who are going to make it hard. But I think generally, I think the market will definitely root out a lot of those people. And people who are interested in being backers get savvy pretty quick. They get burned mm-hmm. once, and they're not going to get burned again, is the way I feel about it. So I think, I'm not generally such a laissez-faire person, but I think, and this is one instance where there's really no amount of monitoring other than whatever Kickstarter is currently doing to make it any safer. I think it really gets down to, if you're going to back a crowdfunded project, make sure it's credible, trust your gut, do your homework. If it looks fishy, if it looks hinky, if it looks like it's just, it's something, or it's a product perhaps it's not going to work, or what I see a lot of these things, Kevin, it's like these devices people want to make, or something to mm-hmm. perhaps put on your iPhone or something like that, and they want tens of thousands of dollars. I have to really look and see if they have a real track record with not only designing things but producing things, and that is a real thing to watch for.
Definitely. Do you have any cool crowdfunding stories that you want to share? Do you share in your book?
I like to talk about some of the mistakes I made. I mentioned that I went with a briefer crowd period. And since you have a crowdfunder, Kevin, mm-hmm. they recommend you do about 28 to 30 days. And I thought, I used to be a fundraiser for politics and some others and nonprofits, and I thought, yeah, but there's that urgency, right? Mm-hmm. So I want to do a three-week campaign. And it did work, but I question that now, and if I had to do it over again, I wouldn't. But the other thing I was going to tell you is I started my crowdfunding adventure on the week of July 4th. And here was my logic going into it this holiday week when nobody's doing anything, right?
Yeah.
My logic was, well, July 4th, people won't be at work. They'll be probably, surfing the web and be interested in books, which is ridiculous. People were, they were celebrating. They were off work. They were on vacation. And, there's a lot of research that indicates a lot of people do their internet surfing at work. So if you look at Kickstarter success in the book, and you get it on your e-reader, there's a graph that shows the engagement for my campaign. And if you look at the first week, it's like nothing until about 3 or 4 days later.
Live and learn, right?
You live and learn. Timing is everything in life, And I made some conclusions, if I could share with you, that I had for the book, which is, one, believe in yourself. If you don't believe in yourself and your project, why should anyone else? And that goes back to your credibility. Two, be organized. Make a timeline, plan a strategy, and stick to it. Three, be creative and credible, as I mentioned. Make a memorable video, use good art, offer valuable perks. You know what kind of perks I offered? Of course, I offered autographed copies of the book, but do you know what one of the more popular things for a higher amount of money, besides ebook downloads of my previous books and autographed copies of the entire series, for a significantly larger investment, I would name characters in the book after the investor.
That is really cool.
It was great. I had two gentlemen do it, but rather than use their names, one of them asked that his daughter be named, and the other one asked that his wife be named. And, of course, I made sure they were not villains, and I made sure that they were portrayed in a great way. And of course, it's not necessarily really them, obviously, but mm-hmm. you want to be careful with that.
And, you definitely do, because they'll talk about it for ages. You know, that'll be one of the dinner table stories of, oh, I'm in a book.
It was kind of funny because one of them was a young lady. She's in just getting into high school, and her character ended up being a explorer EMT. You know, they have a little explorer program for EMTs, mm-hmm. Paramedic things, and her dad's a paramedic. And he said, I want you to use my daughter's name in Pilot's Ghost. And I said, well, okay, I will, but you got to understand, this is a mystery novel, a thriller. It's got some adult situations, adult language in it. And she goes, that's fine. Don't worry about it. Well, then I send him the book and everything, and then the next thing I do, he says, yeah, she took it to school and showed her teacher. Everybody thought it was really cool. And I thought, oh, man. I said, man, what about the language and all that? And he told me, he said, Alex, you really need to get out more. Kids today are a little more
worldly
than you think.
So, Alex, how can people that want to really pursue this world of kickstarting or a little on the edge, how can they go out and buy your book and set their mind at ease and avoid the pitfalls?
And here's the great thing about Kickstarter Success Secrets. First place to look is Amazon.com, Kickstarter Success Secrets, J. Alexander Greenwood. And I'll tell you what, it's a brief book. It will not take you hours to read. It's basically a memoir of my experience with tips and hints and things to do and not do. And it's only 99-cent book. I mean, I made this affordable because people who are interested in crowdfunding obviously don't have a lot of money.
Definitely.
And I was so pleased with what I got. I'm just one of those believers in, you know, paying it forward. So it's a 99-cent book. You can find it at Amazon. You can find it at Sony. You can find it on Smashwords, Barnes & Noble. Should be on iBookstore by now. Anywhere you can find an e-book, you'll find it. And, of course, you can always find me at alexgpr.com, and I can give you more information. And I have a blog there, too.
Okay. Well, that sounds great. Everyone has no excuse not to buy it. 99 cents, you can't beat that at all.
Well, Kevin, thanks. And I've already had two reviews on the book, and they crow about it. And I'm touched because, frankly, I think I wrote this book more for myself just to kind of line out what I did and kind of get my mind right about what I did, and it's really gratifying that people are reading it and enjoying it and getting some use out of it.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and get it for my girlfriend. She's just finishing up her book right now, so I think that'll be very helpful to her. Well, thank you so much for coming on. If you write anything in the future, we'd love to have you back. Maybe talk about your other series.
Maybe, yeah. You know what? The fourth book in the John Pilot Mysteries, I'll be finishing that up this year. Maybe I'll give you a call, and it'd be an honor to come back, Kevin.
That sounds great, Alex. Well, you have a wonderful day, and keep writing.
All right, sir. Take care.
Bye. Next up on Audio Dust Jacket, we have Elaine Bosick with her book, The Last Victim. Welcome, Elaine.
I'm really glad to be here today.
Good. I didn't butcher your last name, did I?
No.
Okay. So I always like, before we go into these books, just to get to know a little bit about the author and just about your background.
Sure. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and I always loved to read stories, and I really think that inspired me to write my own, and I've been writing ever since I can remember. In my professional career, I worked as an advertising copywriter, a magazine editor, a medical writer, and also a teacher in New York City. Now I write articles for Scriptologist.com, which is an online screenwriting magazine, and I live in Florida now.
Okay, so you decided to move out of New York.
Yes, a couple of years ago.
I used to live back there, I think 3 years ago. I lived in Manhattan.
Oh, great place.
I loved every second of it. So let's go into this book. This looks like a just real suspense, great book, The Last Victim. Tell me a little bit about it.
Well, it sounds like a mystery, but it's really a saga.
Mm-hmm.
The Last Victim begins in 1943 on the streets of Brooklyn, New York, where the Rothman family lives. Sophie Rothman, she's the antagonist in the story. She is the mother of three children, and she's obsessed with hoarding money. She dominates her husband and her three children. And she's driven by a very twisted obsession to accumulate money. And she does make a lot of money in real estate, but she can't even spend it on little things to make her life better, her family's life better. And as you can imagine, because of this obsession, she causes conflicts with everyone in her family. She even drives her husband, Harry, away for long periods of time. And eventually, she causes tragedy. On one occasion, when Sophie drove her husband away with arguments over money, she's very lonely, and it leads her into an illicit affair. And when her lover leaves, Sophie discovers that she's pregnant. Well, she's frantic, and she begs Harry to come back. And several weeks later, after he does return, she deceives him into believing that the child she's carrying is his.
Wow.
So Sophie gives birth to Jeannie. Jeannie is my protagonist. And the fate of Jeannie hinges on Sophie keeping her secret. So the story really revolves around this big lie and this deception. Sophie feels that if she can keep her secret, no one will be hurt. But lies have consequences.
Definitely. Continue, sorry.
And Sophie's lie and deception has tragic consequences for everyone.
Well, it sounds like this book has a bunch of twists and turns, and it's very just suspenseful at every turn. How do you come up with your stories? Because this isn't one of the normal of the mill stories. It's not the mystery or this. It seems like a very intricate, very well thought out, unique story.
It is. It actually began when I was in a writing workshop in New York, and I just wrote a scene. It was a vignette, and it took place in a marketplace where I grew up. It was very colorful. There were pushcarts along the streets and tenement buildings, and I wrote this little scene, and I read it to the group, and they were so taken with it, they said, well, this really should be a novel, and I didn't really see how, but I thought about it for some time, and I did go on to develop it into a story with a beginning, a middle, an end. But that scene is still the very first chapter of my novel, and it just kind of developed. The characters took off, and I guess I'm in a different zone when I'm writing because the characters kind of take off on their own, and the story develops. But I always know where my story is going. I always know my beginning, middle, and end. I know where the story is leading, even if things may change along the way. Every action leads to the ending.
So you talked about characters and sort of being alive. How do you come up with your characters?
Well, many of my characters are composites of people I know. I believe that if you want to create characters that are real, they really have to be based on real people. Otherwise, they'll be very wooden. So I more or less give them the characteristics I want them to have so they can clash with each other because, to me, that creates drama. I write very detailed biographies of my characters. I know everything about them from the time they were born, not just their physical appearance, their mm-hmm. likes, their dislikes, their fears, their experiences. Their dreams and goals in life are very important, and all of their flaws. So I know them so well that I know what they're going to do in every situation and how they'll feel and what they'll say to each other. I kind of think of my story as a play with the characters acting out their lives on the stage of life.
So that brings me to my next question. Since you've developed these characters, they've come to life, do they ever surprise you? Are you ever writing and then you're like, well, I think they're going to do this when you're planning out writing, and then they end up doing something completely different because they're alive, really?
Oh, yeah. Sometimes they do when they say things I really don't plan on, and the story spins in another direction. And that happens, and many writers say this, and I think it makes the story more alive when you let that happen. So I have fun with that.
So to me, most people, I normally ask them if it was hard to write this, but it sounds to me like this was easy for you. It just flowed out of you after that first writing session. It sort of just all came together.
Oh, yes. The writing part was the fun part. I also did a lot of research in this book because the end of the book, the the story moves to Israel and the Masada excavation because the protagonist becomes an archaeologist, and she is part of the great archaeological dig in Masada in Israel.
Okay.
And I had to be very accurate about all the details and the artifacts that were uncovered there because my protagonist is making many of these discoveries. So there's a lot of research involved. Even if you're not writing something as detailed as that, there are still details. If you're writing about a period of time, say 1950, 1940, you have to fact check, because if a character is walking past a movie theater, you better know what movie was playing at that time.
Oh, definitely. Because
somebody who's reading the book will know.
And they'll shut off after that, definitely.
Yeah.
So do you plan to write any more books after this? Or is this, you said it's a saga, so.
Yes. I mean, readers have been asking me if I will write another book. Please write another book. They've been so taken with the story. I'm thinking about maybe writing a sequel or an entirely different story, but I'm definitely going to write something else.
That's great. If the readers had to walk away with one thing from reading this book, what do you want them to walk away with, from? Just a good story or a life lesson?
Well, I think I want them to walk away with the main thought that lies have consequences. And lies and deception definitely have consequences. So that's really the main message of this story. Obsession is a very important issue. But The Last Victim is also a love story. Okay. It explores many aspects of love and how redeeming love can be.
It's the entire package.
And there are many themes that emerge from this that I really didn't plan on. But they're in there, and readers like to talk about them and explore them, and I can see from the comments that many of them have written that they are thinking about it.
Well, I love the concept of the book. I love the fact that it's not just the normal lies have consequences that you're getting across. It's that lies have consequences that affect other people, not just yourself. And I think that's a really good point.
Oh, yes, definitely.
So how can our listeners reach out and get this book in their hands because they need it?
Well, my book can be ordered in paperback or digital format on my website, thelastvictim.com or elainebosick.com. It's also available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble in paperback and ebook formats. They can certainly ask their local bookstores or libraries to order the book. I love to hear from readers, so they can contact me directly on my website, and they can write reviews of my novel. I love to hear from readers.
Well, I would tell everyone out there, go ahead, order the paperback. It's a beautiful one. I'm holding one in my hand right now. Just the illustration is gorgeous, and no one really likes ebooks as much as holding one in your hand. So
yes, well, actually, the illustration, the book cover, was done from an original oil painting.
I can tell that.
Which a lot of publishers just don't do anymore because of the cost involved. But I was happy. I was actually very fortunate that my son is a fine artist and also a book cover illustrator. And he agreed to do the cover for me. So
it was wonderful
that it came out that good.
Well, Elaine, thank you so much for being on the show. And to all listeners, go out there and go to the website and order the book or the ebook. And I hope if you write any more books, we can get you back on the show.
Oh, I would love to. It was great talking to you, Kevin, and to your listeners. And thank you for inviting me on your show.
It was a pleasure. Have a great day, Elaine.
You too. Bye.
Bye. Next up on Audio Dust Jacket, we have Jan Karpman with her book, Directional Sense, How to Find Your Way Around. Welcome to the show, Jan.
Kevin, I'm
delighted to be with you.
Well, we are glad to have you here. Can you just give our listeners a brief bio about yourself before we go into this book?
Sure. I have been working as a wayfinding expert for many, many years. I got started in hospitals, which, are, of course, are complex, confusing places, mm-hmm. and found that of all the different issues that could cause people stress, having trouble finding their way around is and was one of the biggest ones. And that, along with my PhD in architecture and sociology, led me on a straight path to being a consultant and doing my best to help people navigate complex places.
That's great. And then you decided to write a book about it, right?
I did. Now, that's a little bit of a different story.
All right, let's hear it.
I'm sorry?
I said, let's hear it. I'm excited.
Okay. Well, that one began for me on a family trip when I was only about 3 years old. I was very independent, even at three, mm-hmm. and I decided, without telling anybody, to take off on my own along the boardwalk. Had lots of pretty rainbow-colored striped cabanas all in a row. But the thing is that they all looked alike. And soon I couldn't tell where I was, and of course, as a good three-year-old, I started to cry. A really nice woman led me back to my frantic mother, and something about this experience stuck with me. Even as a toddler, I felt the frustration of not being able to find my way. So fast forward, as I said, I'm a consultant to large organizations. I work to make their buildings easy to navigate. Places like hospitals, museums, airports, even parking garages need to be more user-friendly so visitors like
Definitely.
You don't get lost, aren't late, and don't end up so stressed out that they don't come back. And so what we do is we plan signs, maps, landmarks to help people get where they're going, even if they're first-timers. So one day, wearing my mom hat, I drove a car full of kids and the teacher on a school field trip. The teacher whispered to me, very embarrassed, that she herself didn't want to drive because she always had so much trouble finding her way around. And a little bell went off in my brain, and I thought, aha, I'll bet I can learn a lot from her. So I paid really close attention. We drove a long way, and she was amazed that I could do things that I thought everybody could do. I could follow kind of sketchy directions. I could quickly recover from wrong turns.
Mm-hmm.
And most amazing to her, I could easily reverse the route and stay the course for the 90-minute trip back to school. So she was the very first directionally challenged person I knew of, but I realized there had to be others. So I interviewed her and her directionally challenged husband and started asking around and, of course, discovered that many people, including some of my very own friends and relatives and lots of other people, experience a consistent difficulty and frustration finding their way. I heard lots of stories of ineffective attempts to navigate everyday places, and I knew that I could help teach them how to do this, and that was the inspiration for our book, Directional Sense, How to Find Your Way Around.
Well, I love that, and I also never would have thought that when I'm navigating my way around a parking deck or someone, that was someone's job to sort of plan that out. That's a cool concept. I don't think people ever realize that on a daily basis. But in this day and age, we all have GPSs on our cell phone. Doesn't that fix the problem of being lost?
Well, let me ask you this. Has the GPS ever led you astray?
Yes, many times.
Yes. Well, that's the answer. The GPS clearly is a wonderful innovation and helps many, many people. However, as you know, it's not absolutely perfect. So let me give you I have a story about that. A woman named Catherine, who is very directionally challenged. She relies on her GPS. One day she was on a trip with her kids and needed to go from their hotel outside Philadelphia to her aunt's home in New Jersey. Her son programmed the trusty GPS and off they went. It was a dark and stormy night, not the best driving condition, but they were confident that the GPS would get them there. As they approached a bridge, they noticed signs that said the bridge was closed. So they turned around and tried another route, confident that the GPS would recalculate for them. But, in fact, it led them back to the same closed bridge. They did this four times in the dark, in the rain, all to no avail. Now they were totally frustrated and late. So Catherine didn't know what else to do, so she programmed the GPS to go back to the hotel and start all over again. She remembered reading our book, Directional Sense, and learning how maps could be helpful. As a directionally challenged person, she felt pretty intimidated by maps.
Definitely.
The first thing you want to do, as I'm sure you know.
But the book explained how they give you the big picture. And she felt kind of desperate at this point, and she didn't want the trip to her aunt's to be a total fiasco. So she got a map at the hotel, and she asked the front desk clerk to highlight her route, as directional sense suggested. So then she and her kids could see that there was another bridge they could take across the river. Although they were really late this time, they made it, and Catherine was inspired to take a look at her map, at a map before her next road trip, just in case the GPS lets her down again. So I think it's important to understand that while you may use it and love it and it's helpful, it's good to know how to use other wayfinding tools to help you when a certain one may not be helpful. And that's true of all of them. Signs aren't always perfect. Maps aren't always perfect. Directions aren't always perfect. So it's always good to have some other information, some other cues, and to know how to use them. And that's what our book does, is it explains how to read and understand signs, how to understand what maps are telling you, and how to use them to answer your particular questions.
Okay. Do you guys differentiate between, I know there's certain kinds of people that are very just like, take a left on Johnson Street, this or that, and then other people are like, well, there's like this store right there, the more visual people like me, where I know how to get places, but I couldn't explain to you how I got there.
Yeah, that's true. I think you're talking about landmarks. And,
yes.
And landmarks are really kind of, I think of them as a secret wayfinding weapon, because they don't rely on this north-south business that a lot of directionally challenged people find really intimidating, and they don't rely on perfectly following directions necessarily. They're visual, they're good for kids to navigate with, they're good for people who may not speak the prevailing language.
Mm-hmm.
They're really useful. So there's several different kinds of landmarks, and it's useful to know what they're about. One kind is that I call these famous landmarks, the Eiffel Tower, the Empire State Building, the Golden Gate Bridge, things that everybody knows that they're big,
yeah,
kind of famous places. And then there are things that are local landmarks, so they're places that the people in your community all know, a certain water tower, a certain rock that people, you know, paint and sign their names on, certain hospitals, restaurants, things like that local people would know. And then there's the third kind, and this is particularly useful and fun for wayfinding, and those are personal landmarks.
Okay.
These are places that may be meaningful to you, the place where you worked, your best friend's house, the cleaners that you always go to. Or another thing that you can do is when you're driving somewhere, you can pick out something and use it as your landmark. So, for example, I was driving down the street one day, and kind of everything looked alike. The houses looked alike. Just the landscape looked alike. And then I saw a mailbox that was shaped like a cow. And I thought, wow, that's really cool. But what that told me was along this long, otherwise undifferentiated road, there was a landmark. And I could remember it. I could recognize it. And when I was coming back, I could look for it. And when I saw it, I'd know that I was on the right track. And so that's what landmarks are really for, to give you reassurance that you're going the right way, that you're on the right track. And if you can use them to add a little bit of fun, a little bit of humor, then that's a bonus.
Well, as a directionally challenged person myself, is being lost always a bad thing? I know my girlfriend laughs at me all the time. We'll be driving around, and I'll go, don't worry, I've been lost here before. So this is all familiar to me.
Yes. Well, it's certainly, you know, there's lots of humor that comes out of people getting lost, and usually if you're somebody who gets lost often, people tease you about it. But the truth is that it's really not funny. It takes extra time if you're lost, if you go the wrong way. It takes extra energy. It sometimes costs extra money. People will take taxis. They'll take tours. They'll pay other people to do the navigating for them if they often get
mm-hmm.
lost. But above and beyond all that, it makes you think less of yourself. It diminishes your self-esteem. If you look around and say, why can all these other people navigate seemingly effortlessly, and why is it so hard for me? So that's something that's important. Something else that it does is it limits, if you get lost often enough, and if traveling to new places is stressful and difficult, maybe you won't do it. So it limits people's experiences, and it limits the places they go, which is unfortunate if that's the reason, because they're afraid. Because it is possible to learn how to do this and to navigate confidently. And finally, it can jeopardize safety. You can end up, if you get lost, you can end up in places where you shouldn't be, or you may have difficulty getting out of places easily. And that's caused, people have certainly gotten into serious trouble that way. So it's not just a nicety. It's not just a joke. It's a life skill. It's an important everyday skill that everyone needs to have, from kids all the way through older adults. And the good news is that it's something that you can learn to do, even if it's something that you've always found difficult.
Well, that's good to know. We've talked mainly about things inside of cars, but you just mentioned safety, and the first thing that came to mind is parking decks. And I know there's a lot of people that you have a long day at work, you're driving. This happens to me occasionally. You forget where you parked your car. Is that common, or?
It's really common. In fact, I'm sure you know the look. You know the look of the person
walking
around the parking deck with the keys
out, trying to beep their car.
The keys. It's very common. Let me tell you another parking-related issue in addition to trying to find the car in the deck. This is a story about Juliana. She was going to pick up her sister at an airport. She was running late, as we all often do, and she misjudged the rush hour traffic. So she was very frazzled by the time she arrived, even though her GPS led her correctly. Although she often has trouble navigating, she's definitely directionally challenged, she found the airport parking garage, dropped her car, ran to the shuttle bus, which took her to the airport, found her sister, who of course was annoyed, had been waiting for a while. The sisters made their way back to the shuttle bus, then to the garage. Juliana led the way to the car, but it wasn't where she thought she'd left it. Her sister rolled her eyes at Juliana and her directional challenges, thinking, oh, there she goes again. And after walking in circles for what seemed like hours, they threw themselves on the mercy of the garage attendant, who drove them around and around and around. Juliana was completely frustrated and furious at herself, but they still couldn't find the car. Finally, the attendant asked her if she was sure she was in the right garage.
Oh, no.
What? She said, isn't there only one? Oh, no, the attendant replied. There are two. An hourly garage and a daily garage.
Oh, no.
Your car must be in the other one, which, of course, it was. So Jill gave Juliana a copy of our book, Directional Sense, for her next birthday, and Juliana learned to pay attention to and even write down which garage or parking lot she is in, as well as the section, the floor, and the space where she's left her car. So, you know, I'm sure your question meant you assume you're in the right garage and you're looking for the car, but sometimes you're not.
Oh, man.
That can really be.
Well, it seems like everyone that is directly challenged or has trouble with this should go out and just buy your book. How can they do that? How can they do that so they can learn these skills?
They can go to our website, which is directionalsense.com. And on the website, they will see on the homepage a copy of the book cover. And if you click on that, you go right to Amazon.com, and you can buy a copy of the book there.
That is great. Do you guys have any kind of blogs or anything where you give daily advice that people can sign up for?
We do. There's a blog on Directional Sense. It's not quite daily advice, but we look at all different kinds of things having to do with navigating. And there are also places on the website where we really like to hear stories from readers, stories about finding your way and stories about getting lost. And also we answer questions that people have about finding their way around. So we really would like to engage with you about all these issues, about finding your way around confusing places.
Well, Jan, thank you so much for informing us about this and being on the show.
It's my pleasure, Kevin. Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, you have a great day.
Thanks.
Bye.
That brings us to a close of another great show. I'm your host, Kevin Finn. For everyone here at the Business Radio X family, we will see you next time on Audio Dust Jacket.